Is it on? 1, 2, 3. Is this? Well, good afternoon. Now I can hear it. Thank you very much. This is a joint meeting of the Senate's Health and Human Services and Housing Committee and the Judiciary Committee. It's January 15th, just a little after 12:30 in room 15 at the Capitol. This meeting is being co-chaired with Senator Latz from the Judiciary Committee. Its goal today is to have an overview of the Minnesota Sex Offender Civil Commitment Task Force final recommendations and to ask the divisions of Human Services, Department of Corrections, and the Minnesota State Court Administrator to address us and inform us as to the implications of that for those various divisions. We also will expect an update from Robin Benson on the Karstens hearing case. And it's for everyone here is a public meeting, but we want you to know it really is an informational hearing orienting legislators and updating us before the session. And with that, I would like to have Senator Latz also welcome you and make a few comments.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm glad we've had an opportunity to coordinate this together between the committees so that we can utilize all of our resources more efficiently, as well as certainly the time of everyone who's interested in the subject will be testifying today. You know, the committee's shared jurisdiction over this issue. You know, we've got corrections and in the courts, and of course there's significant human services issues related here too. So we'll be taking a good look at this and appreciate the opportunity to listen to what you all have to say.
We really appreciate the people that are showing their interest by attending the hearing. We are really trying to orient ourselves and become informed and ask specific information today. If and when the legislation is formulated from these recommendations and comes in front of our various committees, both Judiciary and Health and Human Services, the opportunity for general input will occur at that time. And with that, let's begin. I would also like to explain, please, Judge Magnuson, would you please approach the table, who you'll be presenting on the advisory task force. I would like you, as a presenter and others who are presenting, to know that this there are members of this committee that also serve on a rules committee that is still meeting. And so some of the absent chairs here are related to the fact that they'll get here as soon as they possibly can.
They just adjourned.
Oh, and I guess they just adjourned, so we can expect some people, I hope, to begin to come in. So with that, would you like to begin? Judge
Thank
Magnuson.
You, Madam Chair, members. It's a pleasure to be here today. I understand the demands on everyone's time and look forward to others joining us as they come along. As I understand, I'm asked to give an overview of what our final report was. It's my understanding that you have a copy of that report in front of you. We have also had provided to the committee a couple of resources that I want to make sure everyone is aware of. One is a printout of the link to the web page at the DHS website. It's the URL is available, but basically if you do an internet search for Minnesota Sex Offender Civil Commitment Task Force, you will be directed to that page. The page has both our first report and our final report, and some links to additional information. The most important one, I think, is additional resources and information will take you to a very detailed web page that has, in turn, links to significant background information that was available to the task force and which we thoroughly reviewed in the course of our deliberations. I think that's important to understand because our task force was not the first body to look at these identical issues. There was, among others, the 2005 Governor Plenty Task Force on Sex Offender Policy, chaired by retired Justice Tomjanovich. There was the report of the legislative auditor. There was DHS's own internal review. There are other resources there that give you a great deal of background on how commitment of sex offenders is handled in other states, other programs. There was a major symposium at William Mitchell College of Law last year that provided a great deal of information. And so anyone looking for information on the history of sex offender commitment in Minnesota, alternatives to the Minnesota program, and review and critique of the Minnesota program will find a great wealth of information there. You also have in front of you our report. It was the result of, I think we said, 20 hearings by our task force over a period that spanned the better part of a year and a half or more. We heard from a number of presenters, in addition to having thoroughly reviewed the information contained in the web pages. Minnesota is one of 20 states that civilly commits sex offenders. 50 states do not. As we have discussed both with you in the past and in the report, Minnesota has the highest civil commitment rate per capita of any state in the country. We also have the lowest release rate of any state. And the question is, broadly, why is that? The cover letter of December 2nd to Commissioner Jessen really talks about what we were trying to accomplish as a task force. We wanted to make recommendations on the three specific areas that the federal court had directed that we consider. And in doing that, our judgment was that if our recommendations could focus on how the process could be rationalized, become more objective, and eliminate the influence of politics in the commitment and placement and release decisions, that would address in part the issues raised in the federal court. Now, our report is fairly detailed. It goes along to address the specific issues that the court asked us to look at. And if we've used this shorthand before, there were really three areas of concern that the federal court addressed when our task force was created. One is basically, how do people get into the civil commitment system, the commitment process? There is a question of how they were treated and how they may move through the system once they're there. We referred to that in our first report as less restrictive alternative. Finally, how are people released from the program and what standards should be applied there? We looked at the middle part first at the direction of the federal court. So December of 2012 saw our first report on less restrictive alternatives. And our bottom line there was there need to be more. There aren't any. Under the law as it currently exists, if someone is civilly committed as a sex offender, the presumptive commitment is to the most secure facility, Moose Lake. And while people may move from there to St. Peter, which is roughly the same level of security, there were really, we found no options available for them to move to less restrictive environments, which would be more compatible with the treatment methods and that we're undergoing. So our first set of recommendations was you have to have some less restrictive alternatives in order for the system to function. In our most current report, we looked at how people get into the system and how they get out of it. We started first with talking about sentencing, criminal sentencing. And our conclusion there really was that we couldn't make a recommendation on criminal sentencing because it was beyond both our ability and the charge that we were given. We were not asked to evaluate criminal sentences and whether criminal laws should be changed. although you can't have this discussion without some awareness of the context that leads to many civil commitments. So we made some observations about that, but no recommendation. The next thing we looked at was the screening process, the way in which people are identified as candidates for civil commitment. Who makes that decision and what criteria do they apply? We then looked at petitioning, the process itself. Prosecuting authority, for lack of a better phrase, is the local county attorney. Is that an adequate approach? Are there issues with that? What should what changes might be appropriate? We then talked about the commitment procedures. Who makes the decision? What criteria do they apply? Was the next one the commitment criteria? We made recommendations on that. And then we talked about reduction in custody. What changes in either procedure or law might the legislature contemplate so that someone does not receive what to date has become a de facto life sentence when they are civilly committed? People simply don't get out. Whether that's the appropriate result or not wasn't really our call, but what we wanted to do was see if we could make some helpful recommendations for changes in process, procedure, and standards to address that issue so that people had the chance to come out. Now, I think it's very important when you read our recommendations to start with an examination of the considerations that we identified that guided our decisions. Our ultimate recommendations. They begin at page 2 of the report. We started with the premise that statutory criteria must ensure that the civil commitment process accurately identifies and commits those individuals who present a significant and demonstrable risk to the public, but does not sweep into the civil commitment process those who might not deserve to be there. Our concern there was based on the findings of the legislative auditor that showed that there was a rate of civil commitment, if you will, that proceeded at a fairly level pace right up until the Drew Shadeen incident, which was horrific and appropriately generated tremendous publicity. But without any change in the statutory criteria, the rate of civil commitments increased in a vertical line if it is graphed. That's a very stunning graphic in the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report. The population didn't change, the law didn't change, but the way it was being administered changed, and we wanted to address that to the extent that we could. We talked about process for the identification and treatment of individuals who may be candidates for civil commitment and urge the legislature to carefully consider whether that process of identification and treatment could begin at an earlier stage. Right now, if you are imprisoned for an offense, the review of your candidacy, for lack of a better phrase, for civil commitment really starts at the end of your commitment, your criminal commitment. We heard considerable evidence, and we're, as a group, convinced that treatment of sex offenders is effective. It's particularly effective in the corrections context, and it should start earlier. If you want to put more resources into treating these individuals, that's a good place to do it. We found that current procedures for initial screening and commencement of commitment proceedings resulted in significantly disproportionate rates at which commitment was sought across the country. The legislative auditor, across the state, the legislative auditor identified that as a significant issue. So did the Pawlenty Task Force. The best way to deal with that was the subject of a lot of debate. Some said, well, that's because county attorneys in different counties have different judgments, and we should make that all uniform, and we should have a one-level prosecutor across the state. it could be, you know, the populations aren't necessarily inherently worse in outstate, but you have an 80% referral for commitment in an outstate county and a 40% in a metro county. That is just too big a gap to go unaddressed. And our solution to that was not to localize the prosecution authority, because many outstates counties, it is the Attorney General's office that in fact does the prosecution, but to put another layer of screening in, which I'll explain in a bit. We also found a disparity in the rate at which petitions were granted by the district court judges. Now, it's not nearly as great. You know, it might be 50 or 60% in a metro county and 70% in an outstate county. And we didn't think that that alone was enough justification to consider changing the decision-making process, but we thought there were other good reasons for that. We were also concerned that commitment decisions really are all or nothing. If you're a judge today in Minnesota and you're to decide a civil commitment, as a practical matter, your decision really is, do I commit this person to a life sentence or do I not? The judges have no ability to say, I think this person poses a threat, but I don't think we need to put them in a most secure facility with really no prospect of release. So we urge some specific recommendations on how to give the judge more flexibility. One of them was, and it was contained in the Senate bill that was passed last year, the idea that the judge bifurcate the issues of commit or not commit and placement. How do we best then treat this person once they're committed? We thought that it was very important that an independent judicial body, not one subject to local pressure, make the commitment and the release decision. I'll talk about that in a little more detail as we go along. Today, if you're committed to the sex offender program, it is your obligation to show that you should be moved to a different stage of the program or released. That seemed to us to be inappropriate. The burden should at all times be on the state to establish both the need for commitment and the level of restraint on the individual. So we address that in our recommendation. We were very concerned with how juveniles are treated by the civil commitment process. Right now there are 50-some people subject to civil commitment who've never been convicted of a crime. That is in large part because their offenses were committed when they were juveniles. Juveniles aren't committed or convicted of a crime. That being said, there is a significant body of research that led to a United States Supreme Court decision that said kids are different. The culpability of children whose brains are not fully formed is different. And we thought that it was very important that we recommend that no one should be civilly committed based solely on conduct that occurred while that person was a juvenile. It doesn't mean that juvenile conduct is irrelevant. If they commit an offense while an adult, you certainly want to get the whole picture of the individual. If the only conduct you're talking about is juvenile conduct, that should not be a basis for civil commitment. With that background, I'll address very briefly, because I know you have a lot of other people here to speak to you today, our recommendations. And what we did with each of the recommendations, we hope this is helpful, is for each recommendation we have a statement of what the current law is. We have an identification of the issue, both as identified by us and by the Office of the Legislative Auditor, the Governor's 2005 Task Force, where appropriate, the Department of Human Services, and where appropriate and distinct, our task force. Once we identify current law and issues, we make our recommendation. So what I'm going to do is simply go quickly through the recommendations to hit the high points, and then I'll answer any questions you might have. With regard to sentencing, we made no specific recommendation concerning legislative changes in criminal sentencing laws or the jurisdiction of the Department of Correction. We think there may be viable alternatives, but we really thought that it was outside of the charge we were given by the federal court. The federal court didn't say review and revise the Minnesota Criminal Code. It said look at civil commitment. But we also recognize those things are intertwined. We noted, as reflected in our earlier report, that providing treatment to sex offenders while they are subject to the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections does appear to be effective and cost-effective, and you should carefully consider resources there. Screening. Screening is the process by which someone is identified as being a potential individual subject to commitment. We recite the current law. We note the issue of the statistical variations in the rate of petitions from the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report. We have the recommendations from Governor Polenyi's task force. And what we concluded is that it is often the science that determines whether someone should be subject to commitment and is committed. It isn't the law, but it is basically the opinion of experts, because what we're trying to do is identify those features of someone's personality and behavior that evidence the risk and to predict what risk they may be. That is a very imprecise process. Minnesota does not say if you do four bad things, you're going to be civilly committed. Minnesota has a much more subjective standard. And so our first recommendation is that in order to make sure the science is more precise and is more uniformly applied to the decision to screen someone and recommend that they be civilly committed, to establish a centralized, professionally independent screening unit made up of scientists who will develop and implement a comprehensive assessment process to evaluate sex offenders who might meet the criteria for commitment. Now, currently, there is a screening place, but it isn't as robust as what we have in mind. We certainly did not mean to, say, create a scientific body responsible to no one who has the final word on whether someone should be committed. It's the prosecutor's decision whether to seek commitment. We felt that to address this disparate rate at which commitments were sought, be appropriate to have this independent body. And if the prosecutor in particular county says, I, with all due respect to your professional judgment, we've had experience with this individual, we know our community, other things that would impact the decision, we're going to go ahead and seek commitment anyway, they're perfectly free to do that. However, the screening committee's report, in our judgment, should be part of the evidence that the that goes into the process. We thought that the independent screening unit has to be insulated from political influence, and I have yes.
I just received a note that people are having difficulty hearing you. Can you pull the microphone closer
happy
to you?
Do that. Is that better?
I think.
And I'll just use my outdoor voice too.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. Thank you very much.
The independent screening unit should be insulated from political influence. That's a very difficult thing. I've had people say to me, well, then how are they going to be accountable for their decisions? And that is always an issue when you seek independence, and I'm sure the legislature can find a balance. We believe that the law should charge the screening unit with the production of consistent, accurate, and quality evaluations, and its work, again, should itself be audited every couple of years. And then the last recommendation has to do with the admissibility of it. What we don't want this group to become is a stable of expert witnesses for the prosecution or the defense. So we specifically said no member of this screening unit may be called as a witness to testify. Their report is what their report is. With regard to petitioning, that's the process of actually filing with the court the request that there be a commitment. We think that that process should remain with the county attorney's offices around the state. Local law enforcement is a part of our governmental structure and history. It is an important part. We see great value as a state in having county attorneys rather than state's attorneys because they are sensitive to the needs and circumstances of the local community. And we thought that the issues regarding perceived inconsistent decisions to seek commitment are addressed more appropriately by the screening process contained in the prior recommendation rather than changing who the prosecutor is. Commitment procedures, we outline the current law. We talk about the issues identified by the prior inquiries into this. We talked at length in our sessions about the ability of district court judges not specialized in handling commitment decisions to get to the right result. We have great faith in the judges of Minnesota. They work hard. They take their job seriously, but they may not see all that many of these cases. And the advantage of having a single court that makes both the commitment and the discharge decision is not only will you have a court that develops expertise, but you will have a court that develops a coherent body of decisional authority so that they can turn to their precedent, which is what guides most courts, and say, we have previously done this in similar circumstances. This seems an appropriate result here. That will also provide guidance to the prosecutors and the defense lawyers dealing with this because there will be a more coherent body of law that develops, and those decisions will be reviewable by the Supreme Court. But in this circumstance, most of the law is going to be made in that court. So we recommended the creation of a special SDP-SPP civil commitment court with statewide jurisdiction. We thought that it should be comprised of senior judges who were not going to stand for election. Again, the question is, how are they then held accountable? Well, their decisions are subject to appellate review, and if the system doesn't work, then further changes may have to be explored. But I have great faith in the integrity and tenacity of our judges in this state, and I think they'll do a fine job. Another alternative clearly could be that they be administrative law judges, that they are appointed. On the other hand, that creates at least the possibility of partisanship in the appointment process. And although we considered that, we decided not to make that recommendation. We also thought that it was very important that those who are subject to civil commitment proceedings have available to them competent, well-qualified, and adequately compensated defense counsel. Too often it is difficult for someone subject to civil commitment to find a lawyer who is available, who has the skills and the knowledge and experience to deal with this. There are many cases that lawyers should not handle unless they've handled a lot of them. Trust me, I don't try cases, and I haven't for a long time, and I wouldn't even want to try. But when it comes to appeals, I'm comfortable handling those. It is the same here. We need to ensure that the defense of these individuals is adequate at all levels. We said that this should be a statewide panel, but it should not be state employee lawyers. If you're in private practice and you want to apply to be approved to do this, you have to apply and get certified by the panel. And we said that the legislature should modify current law to provide for a bifurcated hearing process. The first is commitment appropriate. The second stage is where should the commitment be and what should its conditions be. In some respects, this may end up with more civil commitments because the judge is not going to be faced with the very difficult choice of this is, I think, perhaps this person should be committed, but I know it's a lifetime sentence. This will give the judge more flexibility. We talked a lot about the commitment of four criteria. We have the statutory commitment laid out at length. We have a discussion of the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report. And this really hasn't received a lot of attention in the prior reports, but we thought that it was important because civil commitment of sex offenders is based on predictions of future behavior that rather than exclusively on past facts. It is inherently something that involves the exercise of professional judgment and judicial judgment. You're making a prediction of the future. And so we thought that it was very important that the legislature should provide that the independent screening unit that we talked about at the very front end also supply the court and the parties with clear standards on the, not the legal issues, but the psychological and medical issues, and to regularly publish these so that everybody knows what's going to be considered and how much weight it will be given. Reduction in custody took a lot of our time. It took a lot of pages of the report. And we ended up making some fairly concrete recommendations. I believe that there seriously is an issue simply because people don't get out. It cannot be that that no one should ever be released, or if that's what it is, then we say that right up front. We recommended that the legislature modify current law, first of all, to provide for a biennial review of the continued commitment. As I said earlier, right now there's a period of time that you have to wait before you can ask to be released if you're a committed individual, but there is no obligation on the part of the state to continue on a regular basis to justify your retention. We think that the same screening unit that reviews initial commitment should conduct a forensic evaluation and provide a recommendation concerning ongoing commitment and placement. We think that the legislature should modify current law to provide that the commitment court that makes the decision going in makes the same decision coming out. Right now, you have a district court judge in the local venue making the commitment decision, and you have a Supreme Court appeals panel that makes the final decision on release. We think that there will be more uniformity, more rational basis for the decisions, more clarity if the same court decides commitment and release. We think that the same panel of qualified commitment defense counsel who represents persons at the beginning should represent them when the issue of change in placement or release comes up. And we think that at all times it should be the burden of the petitioning authority to show that continued commitment is necessary and justified in what circumstances the commitment should be under. That covered a lot of ground. And some may say that it wasn't specific in some areas, and I agree. In some ways, it is aspirational. When we began this process, I wanted to draft legislation. And the members of the task force who were in the legislature said, no, you don't get it. That's not how it's going to work. We have people who know what they're doing when they draft legislation. And I didn't take that personally. But I think that these provide highlights of the areas of concern, and these recommendations provide, I think, concrete frameworks, a concrete framework for you to move forward as a legislature and address some of these issues. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, Justice Magnuson. Thank you to you and all of the members of the committee for this hard work that you've done. I know that people would like to ask a few questions, but I wanted to, and I apologize to Senator Lori. I should have stated straight out at the beginning that Senator Lori, who is here, is on the Health and Human Services Committee, also was the lead Democratic senator on this task force, attended the meetings, and along with Senator Warren Limmer, who is not here today. Is he coming? Yes, oh, he's there. We want to note you that, that they really put themselves representing the Senate on this task force. So with that, before we take questions for Justice Magnuson, Senator Lori, if you'd like to make a comment at this time, I'd like to invite you to do that.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Sharon. I think that Justice Magnuson did a really good job of summarizing the work of this work group. You know, as legislators, we often sit on task forces and whatnot, and I just want to say this was a really great one. I mean, we had at the end of the task force recommendations is a list of the members who were on this task force, and it was a really impressive group of individuals that have a lot of detailed experience, and we really dug in. We had, I think, 20 meetings and had very good attendance at each and every one of them and had very thorough discussions, and it's a work product that I'm quite proud of having participated in delivering, and really do look forward to the legislature digging in to the recommendations presented here, and look forward to playing an active role in that deliberation process as well.
Great, thank you. And when Senator Limmer returns, we'll ask him if he'd like to add a comment as well. So with that, we'll open it up for discussion. Are there any questions from the members of the committee? Senator Latz. Then we'll go to
thank you, Madam Chair and Justice Magnuson. Just to pinpoint one area where a question popped into my mind having to do with the juvenile offenses, I know there's been a substantial now and growing body of scientific literature on what you referenced in your testimony, the differences in brain development for juveniles as opposed to adults. And my understanding is that the science is showing it continues to develop even as up to the age of 25. And I know in Minnesota, of course, juveniles are under 18. But are there links on your website to some of the scientific background that is the basis for the task force's recommendations?
I don't recall that there are. The United States Supreme Court at Simmons versus Roper, and that decision has an extensive discussion of the scientific basis that supported or justified the United States Supreme Court's decision that it was unconstitutional to execute individuals who committed murder while they were juveniles.
And I've got I think it's a 2011, I'm sorry, Madam
it's
Chair.
Okay.
Justice Magnuson, I've got a 2011 National Geographic magazine at home in which the front cover is all about the teenage brain and a large story on the inside about it. So I guess maybe more for general consideration, this is a topic which is going to spill over into some other issues at the legislature as well. But I appreciate that it's informed this task force's judgment also. Thank you.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Justice Magnuson, piggybacking on his discussion, Senator Latz's discussion, when you say they're juvenile, is that always 18 and under nationally? Or, yeah, under 18 nationally?
Madam Chair, Senator Hall.
Justice Magnuson.
No, I believe the age of majority in some is different in some states. I know that it's 18 in Minnesota, and that's what we were discussing.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Hall.
My question then is, did you discuss or in the recommendation, excuse me, and I don't think I heard you, what would happen to those that are already been committed? Is there a grandfathering thought of new legislation?
Justice Magnuson.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, we talked about that at length. Some of the procedures that we are recommending would certainly apply to everyone who is currently civilly committed. For example, the biennial review, that would apply. You can't go back and change either the procedure or the criteria for the initial commitment. Although substantively those things may be discussed in the biennial review or in the release, just as you can't go back and change someone's criminal sentence. But we think that these procedural changes and the increased use of good science and clear standards would certainly apply to someone who is currently civilly committed when their request is or they're up for review or where their release is at issue.
Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, thank you. And the last question is, do the judges now, when they consider these cases, do they consider the age, whether somebody's 18 versus somebody's 35 or something like that, when sentencing?
Judge Magnuson?
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, age is undoubtedly a factor that the experts consider when they give their recommendation to the court. I've never done one of these. We had judges, we had three or four judges, it's in the list, who have been actively involved in these, and they were all fully supportive of the notion that conduct that occurred solely when you were a juvenile should not be the basis for a civil commitment. There are other ways to deal with that kind of behavior.
One more question, Senator.
Thank you. And, well, where I was going was, as adults, not juveniles, it seems to me that an 18-year-old is really different than a 35-year-old. So I was wondering if judges take that into account right now when they sentence someone.
Judge Magnuson.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, you keep saying sentence, and this isn't sentence. This is civilly committed. And I'm sure that that difference in maturity, for example, when you're making a prediction about future behavior, there is a higher possibility for someone to respond favorably to treatment when they're young, as opposed to someone who is quite old and has set ways. But I think it's a highly individual basis.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hall. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Justice Magnuson, thank you for the overall look at the good work that you've been doing. And as long as we're spending time on page 3 under considerations, those two issues came up. I used to run a juvenile detention facility back in my 20s. I didn't live there. I ran one. But the special issues that you talk about regarding developmental disabilities, now I know some folks that were on the task force have some DD background. Is there a specific recommendation that you guys are giving other than, you say, special criteria and procedures? Is there a listing? Did you have a deep conversation about that? And I guess, A, can we get that information?
Judge Magnuson.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, we didn't identify those with specificity, but, for example, the notion that someone who is incapable of walking under their own power, or who is so mentally impaired that they really can't, they couldn't plan an escape if they wanted to, should nonetheless be sent to the most secure facility, right, Moose Lake, was a concern. That those individuals need other kinds of treatment and accommodation. Right now, it is too much of a one-size-fits-all. If you're committed, you're committed to Moose Lake, and you may move to St. Peter, but that's true whether you and we talked about this. There are people who are who probably warrant civil commitment for the rest of their lives. Now, I'm not making that judgment about anyone in particular, but these people, they're individuals. They're not all the same. And so what we found disturbing was that there was very little ability to differentiate between individuals in the commitment decision.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you for that that explanation, Justice Magnuson. And I look forward to, getting deeper in the weeds on that. I'm glad that you found that there were some discrepancies and that the one-size-fits-all isn't a way to do business here in Minnesota. So, again, thank you for your work on this.
Judge Magnuson, I appreciated your comments earlier in response to Senator Hall, because sometimes our conversation gets confused about what we might do in the future in terms of sentencing of offenders, and get confused in a way that stops us from doing what we need to do with the existing sex offenders who are the subject of the court case that we're reviewing. And if I understood you, that it will be possible for us, within all the ramifications of law, to apply elements of this report that are about treatment or about how a person moves through the system of after civilly committed. Those elements of the recommendation, if adopted, can apply to the existing population of civil committed persons. And we need, if we change the overall sentencing process for persons who commit sex offenses, that will not impact those that have already completed a sentence and are under a civil commitment process. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I think that's a very accurate statement. When you're convicted of a crime, you get sentenced. The state cannot come back after the fact and say, we're going to make that sentence different, more onerous. When you are civilly committed, you are civilly committed. The state could, I suppose, decide that it's going to abolish civil commitment, and it's going to release anyone who has been civilly committed. At the same time, that recognizing that's not likely, the state can change the process for moving through the system and being released from the system.
Okay, great. And then one of your recommendations, when you're talking about this centralized group of experts who will make recommendations for whether a person meets a criteria for civil commitment, you've recommended that we not make that criteria so flexible, or I don't know if that's the term, elastic, I think, is the term that you use, that we refine that with more clarity to increase the consistency statewide in terms of civil commitment. And there were a number of recommendations to increase consistency. And you asked this group that would be formed of experts to clearly define so that the person who has committed the offense, the people that represent them, the county attorneys, everybody understand what is looked for to determine what are the conditions for civil commitment. And then again, what those risk factors are. And so this special group is going to come back, if I understood you correct, with information about what the risk assessment process contains, that it's a science-based, it's a proven methodology of some sort that we can expect from a group of people that helps. They'll be responsible for determining that methodology upon which they do the assessment and make a recommendation. Did I understand that correctly?
Madam Chair, I think that that is part of our recommendation, that to the extent we possibly can, we have a group of independent experts identify the scientific methodology, the psychiatric, sociological, psychological metrics that should be used. Do you use this test, or this test? To what degree do you weight those particular things in the average case? But they're developing standards, they're developing criteria, and they are charged with constantly researching that to make sure that they are at as well-defined as they possibly can be. They are not adjudicators. The only thing they do is, at the very beginning and at the very end, they do a screening function to say, applying the criteria we've developed, we believe that commitment is warranted or not warranted, release is warranted or not warranted, but they're not adjudicators. They are simply saying, we're the ones that study the science independently, and if we were to apply it here, we'd reach this result. That doesn't mean that when you then have a hearing, that can't be challenged. Mm-hmm. The parties would bring in their expert witnesses. They would have real advocates arguing, and that would just be another piece of information. But what you would get is a consistent framework against which the individual circumstances are measured.
And the audit, thank you, Judge, the audit of this is of this group, correct?
It is of this, Madam Chair, the audit is of this group to make sure that they're doing what we think they should be doing.
And that might include that they are continuing to explore the current and best science for applying this assessment process for their recommendations.
Yes.
Thank you. Hello, Senator Limmer is here. I was saying earlier, Senator Limmer, that I had missed the opportunity to thank both you and Senator Lurie for your service, and offered Senator Lurie a chance to make a comment about this, because you served us well on the committee. But would offer that to you now if you'd like to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What did Senator Lurie say?
He said he did all the work.
Madam Chair, some of us in the Senate, both Democrat and Republican, have been seeing a tidal wave coming at us from a judicial standpoint regarding those that are enrolled in the MSOP program. Many of us had anticipated that there would be constitutional questions, not to mention the cost factor is rather significant. It's about 300 to 400% higher than holding an individual in a correction facility. And a lot of that has to do with the staff and the other facilities that are unique to civil commitment and not so much with corrections. But at the same time, it's such a large disparity that it cannot be ignored. And I know that every year we have questions of resources and resourcing other needs of state government, not only needs of government, but needs of individuals, whether it's health care or school funding. Our list of potential real priorities are long and tall and very wide. And anytime we can look at a very costly program, and which is already raising questions about it, we should examine it. This program has been in existence for over 20 years. There were a number of us that went down and took a tour of the facility at St. Peter. And we were told at that time by the then director that we were the first organized legislative group to come and visit that facility in the history of their program from a group dynamic. And I thought that was rather unique. This population is one that the general population generally wants to, once they have a court hearing, they want to put that person in a box and turn the key and never look back. And I think to some degree, legislators are also reflective of that same attitude. And so with the result of now a court taking very careful examination of it and asking us to look carefully at what we should be doing in examining, they're highly expectant of us to give them a serious analysis and a return of action based on what we find. And the Chief Justice here was led the task force for over a year. And I think overall we did good work. We examined all of the elements. We made recommendations. And now it'll be up to the legislature to figure out if we want to go down that path or not. But there is a consequence for doing nothing. And the consequence, I know we've had lots of discussion about it, but it may create a MSOP program that none of us may like if a federal court is the instrument of doing it. I believe the Chief Justice here has said correctly that over time it's a rather blunt instrument. Courts are not designed to make public policy. That's the role of a legislature. And so I think it would behoove us to make sure that we carefully examine, make presentation, do our thing as far as going back and forth, questioning, challenging premise. That's what we do best. And as a result, hopefully that crude rock of a bill will become a jewel that we can rely on. Every other state has solved this problem, except Minnesota. Minnesota is the one outlier that has constitutional questions raised on it. There's plenty of states that what one could use as a role model, and we have focused on a few of those states. But I'm always amazed at the voices that may answer a different call and think that it's a temptation to get political with it. And I really hope that the legislature on the whole refuses to take that temptation. This is a very serious issue and a very serious consequence if we do nothing. Inaction is not an option. So I'm my hat's off to you, Madam Chair, for being involved in it, having public hearings. And the purpose of public hearing is not only for us to understand it, but we want the public to understand the issue involved so they can kind of follow along with us at the challenge that we have before us. So nobody's surprised, but that we diligently examine and solve this issue.
Oh, thank you, Senator Limmer, and thank you for thanking me, but I can tell you that there are many senators, Senator Limmer and Senator Hahn, have been very helpful in accomplishing the goal that you just talked about, which is to depoliticize this conversation. And that would be my final question for you. I know you can't say anything for certain, Judge Magnuson, but based on your experience and your instincts, do you think that if we are able to implement most of the recommendations that you've made here in the three parts of our system, how you get in, what happens once you're in there, and then the process for getting out, will we have been responsive adequately to the concerns of the court?
Even when I was a justice, I could not read the minds of trial judges. I know that Judge Frank announced at the hearing on the motions that were recently heard that he'd get a decision out in 60 days. I think that he is judging what is in front of him now, and if what is operating in the future is something different from that, it would be a different question. So that's the best that I can say. Whether he feels that there's been, it kind of depends on what he finds. If he finds that there are significant problems, do those problems match up with what we have made recommendations on? I don't know.
I don't know. I knew you didn't know.
That's the simple
but
answer.
I hoped you make a guess. Make a guess. I should know better than ask a Chief Justice to make a guess.
Former Chief Justice.
Former Chief Justice. Once a chief, always a chief. Okay, great. With that, unless there is a question unanswered, there'll be more opportunities, I'm sure, to talk about this as we move forward in the session.
I have no doubt. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much. Okay. On our agenda, we have Commissioner Berry next, but she's not here yet. She is here. Well, I guess she is here, so then we'll stick with the agenda and begin now with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Welcome to the table, Commissioner Berry. Once you get settled there, you can talk with us a little bit about what the department would like us to know about the recommendations that you have heard.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Ann Berry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And we don't have a formal response to the report. The report, as you know, is part of an order from Judge Keyes and Judge Frank, actually, in the litigation, the Karzgen's litigation against the department. And so their response by the department was not called for, that action wasn't called for. But I wanted to just run through a couple of things that I thought were important for the committee to know about the recommendations and trying to tie them back to the recommendations of the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report, because there clearly are many that are very consistent, and we have been on record as supporting many of the recommendations of the report of the Legislative Auditor. If there's hesitation in my responses or if I think longer than I normally do to respond, it might be because, it most likely is because we still are in the middle of litigation on this topic. And so, again, I'll do my best to try to address all of the questions that are raised by committee members when presenting. First of all, want to reiterate our support for the action that was moved forward by the Senate last session, your bill, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. That would have begun to push us in the development of less restrictive alternatives. Clearly, we are on record supporting that effort. It is part of the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report. It is clearly part of the task force recommendations. We remain committed to the development of less restrictive alternatives. As you know, we released a request for first a request for information and then a request set of requests for proposals. We have received back interest from community providers who are willing to serve populations who have sex offenses in their histories. More than we thought might be available. We are also prepared to develop services out of direct care and treatment, out of our programs, because we too could run less restrictive alternatives. We would have to use resources that are currently available to the department. But at this point in time, we're really focusing on the requests for proposals and the responses to those proposals. Some of the other recommendations from the task force report are really will be addressed by others who will be presenting today. Recommendations for the courts, recommendations for the Department of Corrections. Some of these recommendations really are what happened to clients before they come to us or what happens upon their release. And we have always gone on record stating that our job or our responsibility is to treat those who are committed to us, to treat them and provide treatment in the most appropriate way, and then provide recommendations for appropriate placement into the community. We still believe that it is the court's responsibilities to make the commitments to our program, and the same those who would have a reduction in custody or provisional discharge or a movement to the community would be the decision of the courts. And so we don't have a position on the task force recommendations as they relate to those issues. And I know that you're going to get at the end of this hearing really just a very quick status update on the litigation. It'll be very procedural in nature, obviously. There were motions presented to the court. Robin Benson will run you through those. And as Judge Magnuson suggested before I came to the table, Judge Frank has said he there will be some sort of response within 60 days, which puts us in the middle of February. Some of the other recommendations of the task force didn't really focus as much of its time and recommendations on some of the treatment items that were included in the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report. So it's not my intent to run through those in the Legislative Auditor's report. Those were a number of other recommendations that were made to the department to not only add staff but add treatment hours, and many of those items have been addressed, and we certainly could provide an update to you like we have with other auditors' reports. But really, those are again, we don't have a formal response to the task force recommendations, so I'd be willing to sit for any questions that you have.
Senator Cohen, please begin.
Madam Chair, Ms. Berry, so just hypothetically, what happens, hypothetically, if Judge Frank issues an order based upon his interpretation of the program that releases everybody and stays the order for 6 months and kicks it over to us saying, we'll give you some time to figure it out? At that point, is there a response from the department in terms of what you would suggest? Or will you be dependent on a legislative recommendation, either as authored by the chair or somebody else, if it were to pass the legislature?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Berry.
Madam Chair and Senator. One of the other things that we've worked really hard to do is not to speculate about what the court may do. You know, we are currently under a settlement in the Jensen matter, and so have some experience with the court and the court monitor as it relates to a previous settlement that the department is under. But if, in your hypothetical situation, the department was ordered to release clients and that the order would be stayed for, I think you said, 6 months, clearly the department, with representation from the Attorney General's office and with the governor's office, has legal options, obviously, to any kind of an order given by the court. So we would consider all options at that point in time. We would look at, you know, our legal options. There is always in the process of litigation the opportunity to continue settlement discussions. But I think there was a very strong message from the court and has been all along that it is their hope that the legislature would act.
Okay, so Madam Chair,
Senator Cohen,
let me ask the question slightly differently, Ms. Berry. So let's say the legislature acts. Is the governor simply then prepared to sign or veto whatever the legislature passes?
Madam Chair?
Ms. Berry, I didn't understand the question. Would you repeat the question?
Well, the question is, Ms. Berry indicated toward the end of her answer to my question that depend on what the legislature does. So if the legislature passes something, will the governor be involved in the promulgation of that legislation, or will he simply sign or veto whatever the legislature were to pass? And the corollary to that question, Madam Chair, is if we don't have the engagement on the part of everybody, as opposed to just the Senate, you know, what's the point?
Ms. Berry.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'll use last session's activity as an example. The governor's office and the department were clearly involved in the development of and the language around less restrictive alternatives. I expect that would be the same path we would head down this session, so that nothing is a surprise to the governor at the point in time where he was required to either sign or veto a bill. So it's really premature, I think, for me or anyone from the department to talk about what the governor will do. But our plan and our path would follow, I would hope, would follow the one from last session, which is we work together to shape the language, and we would make ourselves available clearly to both the Senate and the House to develop any language that would be included in bills that would be put before the governor.
And I would also add that my intent would be to have the Senate do what it can within its sphere of influence. And we don't have control beyond that. But for us to take what we think is the responsible actions and have the responsible debate within our hearing process, take the action we think is appropriate, and beyond that, we really rely on others to do their part. So I would like to ask you about the administrative efforts, Commissioner Berry, to pursue through a request for proposals less restrictive alternatives. That has been an action that the department has taken some time ago, has gotten the information, I suspect, some time ago. So my question is, within the authority that you have now to develop that, when can we expect, regardless of whether there is action by the legislature, for the development of less restrictive alternatives, which could be utilized by the court without us taking a legislative action? When can we expect to see that actually something that the courts could use?
Madam Chair, there were at least two activities the department was engaged in. One was the request for proposals from private providers, and we were looking to do state development as well. And as you know, we were on a track to repurpose one of our current facilities. We have stopped that activity at this time, but still have the track for the request for proposals. Because I think it's important for everybody to remember that we still have clients who are making their way through the process, the court process. We have clients that have been recommended for placement or provisional discharge or transfer by the Special Review Board, and those cases are on their way to the Supreme Court Appeal Panel. Now, you know that based upon the governor's direction, the commissioner is not able to support any additional activities or any additional client movement, but she is only one part of this process. The Supreme Court, again, I'll just reiterate what I said earlier, the Supreme Court appeal panel could still make a decision to provisionally discharge or transfer a client, and we would have to have a place for that client to be provisionally discharged or transferred to. So we have to continue the community development. We have at least three community providers that we think are prepared to take clients upon provisional discharge, and potentially they could be used for transfers as well.
But is it possible, Commissioner Berry, on the front end, when the client is in the process of completing their sentence and considered for civil commitment, if the court at that time, even though the system at this time is not bifurcated, and they make the decision in one hearing about commitment and then placement, right now there's only one option. This request proposals could create alternative options to Moose Lake and St. Peter. So it has its benefit on the other end as well. And so I'm not just asking about the discharge or the provisional discharge. I'm talking about what we can do without legislative action to begin to offer alternative placements, because as Senator Hoffman indicated in the conversation with Judge Magnuson, there are certainly groups of people who are inappropriately placed in that most intensive and restrictive facility.
Madam Chair, you are correct that these RFPs or these responses that we have received from community providers could be used for that process of people who are committed to the commissioner for treatment at the end of their time with corrections. So yes, it's another option that would be available within our authority. The way the requests were developed were for the discharge, but there's no reason that those same providers couldn't negotiate some kind of an arrangement so that they could be used for other purposes as well.
Well, let me just say to you at this time, since none of us want to guess about what might happen either by the federal court or by this legislature, that I think that would be a very good idea to demonstrate that it, even without legislative action, that the Department of Human Services is taking action to create alternatives on the front end as well as on the back end, so that another letter requesting proposals for how there might be community placements for civilly committed persons other than Moose Lake could happen. I would appreciate that, and let me know how that goes. Are there other questions from the committee for our commissioner? Well, thank you for coming. We'll see you again, I'm certain. And now we have Commissioner Roy. He's with the Department of Corrections. Welcome, Commissioner Roy.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Tom Roy. I'm Commissioner of Corrections. Inevitably, the Department of Corrections is brought into this discussion of civil commitment because of we are considered the feeder system for civil commitments. And we expend an extraordinary amount of manpower in not only incarcerating sex offenders, but also in the treatment of sex offenders, and ultimately the evaluation of sex offenders upon their release. I'm going to immediately draw your attention to two documents that we have provided to the committee, both labeled fact sheets with the Department of Corrections logo on the top. And I would first like to address the one entitled Sex Offenders in Prison, because I think it's very important for you as committee members to know the volume of cases and the types of cases that we are dealing with every day.
And Commissioner, will you be... In talking about the existing population, I'm hoping that besides simply a description of the existing numbers, that you talk to us about how the recommendation to initiate treatment in the correction system in an earlier process is heard from your perspective, what you're hearing or what you're thinking about in that regard.
And, Madam Chair, that certainly will be the key to my next discussion on the Lionel Lakes document, which describes our treatment and the efficacy of that treatment, which has come up numerous times in the task force. I should probably say that I was a member of the task force as well. I'm also a member of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and formerly a probation parole officer who supervised sex offenders for years and years and years. So I'm about 39 years into this subject area, and every day it's getting better. As you can see, and I'm not going to go over every statistic on these sheets, so I would like to draw your attention to the second paragraph on the first document. Over 3,000 sex offenders in our facilities at the present time. There's some discussion about those that are in for their exact sentence to be a sex offense, and there are those that are inside for a subsequent offense but having a previous sex offense. But it is a substantial number of offenders currently in our facilities. And the bottom graph, bottom right, shows the growth of sex offenders in our facilities, and also the top line, the growth of our prison population generally. And I think we should be somewhat relieved that the growth of our sex offender population is fairly static, and we are not experiencing great growth in that area. If we flip it over, I think it is very important to talk about the victimization of these sex offenders. We have not heard the word victim today yet, but I think it's very important to talk about victims. And especially the top right-hand corner, that in that paragraph, 20% of the victims are adults. Over 65% are females under the age of 16. And I think if, in fact, we are going to focus on preventive activities, and the task force did talk about prevention and the public effort to inform people about victimization and how to avoid being a victim, I think that is a key statistic. Also related to that statistic is a little known or little shared statistic that about 92% of sex offenses are committed by people known to the victim. Stranger assault, stranger sex assault is relatively rare in Minnesota. It is, and it's the popular press and media tend to focus on sex offenders as a homogeneous group who all commit alley rapes. But in reality, it is usually somebody known to the victim, an acquaintance, a family member, a person in authority. And I think, again, in terms of prevention and in terms of public perception of sex offenders, I think that is so important to emphasize. This document will be hopefully help you define some course and as you formulate legislation, but in the interest of time, I will move to the second document. Which
before you do that, I've been quickly reading through this, and I need a couple of definitions from you.
Sure.
I'm trying to figure out what a governing sex offender means.
GSO is a statistical description where that person is in prison specifically for a sexual offense. The second category, OSO, is that he may be doing time for a burglary, but in his history has had a sexual offense.
Okay, thank you.
And in both instances, we have to address that sexual offending, of course.
And so a person who might enter the program that you have at Lionel Lakes for sex offenses could either be there for a sex offense or have a sex offense history,
though
they're incarcerated for a different crime.
Madam Chair, that's correct, and we triage those cases to make sure that the most serious get treatment. And that leads very nicely into the next description of our treatment services at our Lino Lakes facility, which is our primary treatment facility. And I am not going to go into the treatment modality, but I will quickly go to the second page, the backside, and in the middle column at the bottom identified as treatment effectiveness, because I think that has came up numerous times in our task force discussion. How good are you folks in the corrections department at treating sex offenders? And I would propose and tell you folks today that I think we are doing a pretty darn good job. Are we 100% effective in reducing recidivism? We are not. But I think that paragraph that describes the reduction in convictions of future sex offenses is pretty significant. And I think I made the case last year in front of both of your committees, I think, in terms of requesting additional treatment dollars, and I'm so grateful that you provided those to us. And we are expanding our sex offender treatment because we know it reduces future crime. And we know for sure, well, I should never say for sure, but I have a strong feeling that our treatment in prison will reduce the numbers of potential civil commitments. And Judge Magnuson did, in fact, talk about our discussions at the committee. And I know there are legislators that are interested in perhaps having a corrections alternative to civil commitment, a more robust treatment program perhaps, some adjustments in sentencing practice perhaps. And I hope this, and we have much more research that would support, and nationwide research that would support treatment, good treatment in prison does reduce future crime. Judge also talked about the fact that prior to release from prison, and the civil commitment process begins a year before, about a year before, 12 to 14 months before an offender gets referred for petition for civil commitment. We have a very skilled professional behavioral science group, and a few of them are sitting behind me. Those folks are, I think, as good as it gets in the corrections world in terms of using actuarial tools. Our research department has created actuarial risk assessment tools that are used nationwide, and we're very proud of that work. Using that science, then, we become the referral source for petitioning for civil commitment. And the judge did make reference to the Drew Shardine 2003 time. It just so happened that I did produce a bar chart with 20 copies for future distribution of the referral rate. And this might be good for this discussion if a staff member could distribute, and I apologize for...
We have someone coming.
Very good. To put the words behind the chart, in 2003, there were 14 referrals to county attorneys for civil commitment out of our department in early 2003. In December and following into 2004, again, 14 referrals, that number jumped to 236 referrals, with 70 of those referrals ending up in a petition and a commitment. And that is very clearly demonstrated from 2003 to 2004. Since that
Excuse
time,
me, may I ask you a quick question
sure.
there? You indicated that you're describing the difference that occurred since Drew Shardine in terms of the numbers.
Yes.
Process hadn't changed, as Judge Magnuson said, but the number of referrals and the actual civil commitments just exponentially rose at that time. Are all, and you said initiated by the Department of Corrections, is it also possible that you might not initiate that, but then the county attorney would also be an initiator of that? Or does it come through the Department of Corrections, the initiation for the process?
Madam Chair, these were forwarded those numbers were our departments forwarding for petition, and I can't speak to the independent.
But that's petition. Possible for an independent petition. Simply because you don't request it doesn't mean it couldn't be initiated by the county. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I'm sure that there were petitions.
Beyond that. Okay.
However, I have, I'm aware that county attorneys are reluctant to move forward with a petition without supporting documents or a recommendation from the Department of Corrections. That number, if you recall, in 2003, 236 forwarding petitions. We have continued tracking those numbers, and in 2013, 69 cases were referred for petition. So only about a third or so of what happened. There's been a steady decline, and as you look at that graph down to 2011, my apologies for not having the 12 and 13 in there, but pretty consistent numbers. So I think generally there's a belief that, and the practice is, and the science is getting better, that there is a more discerning group of people looking at civil commitment. And there's also a potential that the fact that you have so many civilly committed now, that the pool for potentials is not on the streets able to reoffend. We are also, and I'm going to refer you back to the treatment, the final paragraph on the second page of the LINO document. You will see that from 1990, that final paragraph describes the significant reduction in recidivism from 1990 to the analysis we did of 2002 releases. And that final sentence, I think, talks about the initiatives and the work that you folks did as legislators in defining more robust community supervision, increased collaboration of treatment providers. A community notification certainly has had an impact. And that we believe that combination of effort and community awareness has brought recidivism down significantly. And if we can claim some ownership of that, I'm very happy to do that. But I sense it's a more community engagement in this issue. There is, however, another side to that community engagement and community effort and the existence of the World Wide Web. It is very difficult in this world now as a sex offender to engage in civic life and to become stable. And they have a very hard time gaining stability in housing and employment and a general acceptance back into the community. We, on a very daily basis, struggle with housing for sex offenders. And if I was to caution both committees on the civil commitment, less restrictive community alternatives, this location, physical siting of treatment facilities, housing facilities, and transitional facilities is going to be a major hurdle for you as legislators. It's going to be a major hurdle for local communities to accept the placement of these folks back into the community. We are all cognizant of the experience in Cambridge. I was there in the evening meeting. The challenge that we are going to have as a state in this area is going to be significant, and I would not underestimate the intensity of reaction when somebody says these folks are coming back into your community. I truly believe, as a 39-year professional working with sex offenders, that it is a community safety issue, and I support fully the transition of sex offenders back into the community, because it is demonstrated that these folks that transition methodically using the best treatment available become less risk to the community. And our research also demonstrates that when we release sex offenders, and some do expiration of sentence and are released directly onto the street, statistically, those folks reoffend at a higher rate. The best absolute strategy is to transition these folks, not only our folks in the Department of Corrections, but also these folks who are civilly committed. It has to be methodical. It has to use the best science. And I was very, very appreciative that the task force identified best practice and science as a foundation for the future work. We have all kinds of numbers, and the last thing I'm going to talk about is a very important document that you folks should use as a foundational document, and it is prepared by the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines every year. It's entitled Sentencing Practices, Criminal Sexual Conduct Offenses. It's on their website, and I'll make it available to staff. But just to every question that you could potentially ask about how sex offenders are sentenced in Minnesota is answered by this document. Who are the victims? What's the relationship? What's the length of sentence? How many sentences are departed downward? How many stay locally in local facilities? It's a fairly daunting, comprehensive product, but it's so impressive. And Director Mitchell, who's in the room today, the director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, should be very proud of this work, and I would encourage all of you to use it. It also gives the separate discussion of these criminal sexual conduct sentencing guidelines grid, and I know that has been a focus and perhaps is an alternative that some of you are considering adjusting as a solution to this particular issue. I will certainly entertain questions. I have probably 10 other documents I could share with you, but I will avoid doing that because I know your time is limited. So I do thank you for your attention.
Great. Well, I will ask some questions right away, Commissioner Roy. In relationship to the recommendations which might encourage the utilization of the treatment program through the Department of Corrections more, that really is something that I understand you to be saying you're capable of doing, willing to do, as long as you get enough resources to make that possible for you to do. Correct? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is very correct, and we are very proud of our work, and we think we can impact public safety significantly with good treatment in prison.
But your program is a voluntary program. These people are not required, but could they, in the sentencing process before coming, be required in a sentencing process to say that your sentence is such and such, reduced only if you successfully complete the corrections treatment program? Is that a possibility in a sentencing process? Do you know?
Madam Chair, under the guidelines, it is a determinant sentencing system. So a person walking out of the courtroom who does not want to comply in any way, shape, or form cannot be held in forever. At some point in time, that door opens, and that's very prescriptive in the sentencing guidelines.
But if we could change the sentencing guidelines, I'm asking, could we change the sentencing guidelines to make it indeterminate sentencing, with the carrot being that if you make a successful, sincere effort at a treatment process, that would allow a reduction or, you know, an end time to that sentencing process? We could make a change like that.
Madam Chair, I do believe that incentive built into sentencing would affect some offenders positively. We will still always have a group of offenders who have no interest in being.
That's right. I understand that. That's why they're going to be civilly committed to a different place, right? So I also heard you talking about, in a positive way, about the expertise that you are experiencing with the use of a scientific basis for risk analysis and assessment that you think is pretty top of the line and the best practices that we have right now. Is it the same process that is used for risk analysis in the Department of Human Services?
Madam Chair, we do share the use of certain actuarial tools in addition to the ones related directly to sex reoffending. We also have one called the LSIR, which looks at general criminogenic risk factors, and we are also just recently starting to use a new tool called the MNSTARR, M-N-S-T-A-R-R, and the author is actually sitting behind me, and we are hopeful that this new risk tool looks at the potential for violent reoffending and sexual reoffending for those that have no prior history. So we do believe that we are on the cutting edge of actuarial risk assessment, and we are publishing nationally and getting recognition nationally for our work. So we're very proud of it.
Well, I'm interested in what you're talking about, because if, and I am not able to determine that, but if it is the best we have, you know, in terms of determining risk on a variety of factors, why wouldn't we be utilizing that same model for those who are already civilly committed and being considered every 2 years, for reviewed every 2 years, or under the current system when the client requests a review? Are we using the same tools, and if not, why not? Are we measuring different things or have different outcome measures that we're looking for? Why wouldn't we be using the same model if it is an excellent assessment tool?
Madam Chair, the academic papers related to risk assessment of sex offenders vary in length from 40 to 400 pages. It is a body of science that is fairly recent. There are detractors who believe that risk assessment tools are a part of a total assessment package. And those that have developed sex offense assessment tools always will preface their results with saying people, the assessment relates to people who have similar results. Mm-hmm. If you fall into this profile, it is likely that you will not reoffend at this rate, or you will reoffend at this rate. It is not person-specific, but it provides a profile of a similarly situated person. And in some cases, our actuarial studies, we look at 2,000 to 4,000 offenders and extrapolate risk based on real results. Did those people reoffend over the course of time in the first year, second year, third year? So it is not a perfect science, and I think all the sciences, all the scientists and social science people will say it's as good as it gets. It's not perfect.
And I appreciate that, and I'm hearing you say that it is as good as we are able to do at this time in the Department of Corrections. But there's also a similar process that occurs for those already committed that are in the Department of Human Services. My question is, are they using a different model of assessment? And if so, why? Perhaps you can't answer that, but I would like an explanation to if it's the same, if it's different, why, and if it's just two departments disagreeing about which the best method is for assessment. So I think the process of doing good assessment for determining the appropriate placement and the level of risk, you know, we're asking if we release people, the community takes the risk. That's why the community comes to these hearings. They're concerned about the level of risk that they're willing to take on. That this is critical, that we are able to say to the public that we're using the best that we have and that we have good outcomes from it, whether it's done at the Department of Corrections or at the Department of Human Services. So my question is not so much about what you're doing. It's about, are you doing the same thing as the Department of Human Services, and if not, why not? And that's all I'm asking.
Madam Chair, I'm not smart enough to speak for the clinicians, either in my department or the Department of DHS, and we collaborate closely with them. We share common tools, but Obviously, our missions are different, and I'm confident that the directions of the task force and the many comments within the body of the report that talk about best available science, we share that, and I know the DHS folks share that as well.
Are there any other questions for Commissioner Roy?
Manager.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to follow up on a conversation or a question that you were asking earlier. So currently, does everybody in the correction facilities that want sex offender treatment, are there enough beds and space, and do they get treatment?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Roy.
Senator, we are only meeting about 30% of our treatment obligation for sex offenders. And if you recall last year, I gave you lots of numbers that convinced you to a degree that we need to do better. And if this was a funding year, I know I would be sitting here and asking you for additional treatment money. And next session, I expect that if everything goes the way I hope it goes, I will be sitting here asking you for additional treatment money. But we aren't meeting the need, clearly.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you for your
with that,
time.
We will now move to Jeff Shorba, who is with the Minnesota State Court Administration. Welcome to the table. Please introduce yourself, Mr. Shorba, for the record, and you can begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committees, my name is Jeff Shorba. I am the State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. I'm happy to get the invitation to come and chat with you a little bit about the recommendations of the task force. Our Judicial Council has not taken an official position on the recommendations, so I'm really here to talk to you about my office's initial thoughts about some of the recommendations. As Chief Justice Magnuson said, the task force recommendations change the role of the commitment and review process to put a large deal of responsibility on senior judges or retired judges. We call them senior judges in the judicial branch. In particular, the recommendations require us to have what is seen in the report as a cadre of senior judges who could gain experience in this area of the law and also provide some consistency in their judgments. The role of committing individuals right now is done by district court judges, and what this report does is it not only takes that role away from the district court judges, but it also expands the role. As Chief Justice Magnus has said, it is now a bifurcated process. So you have an initial decision as to whether to commit someone and then a secondary decision as to the type of placement for that individual. We are going to be doing some additional work with our judges, especially those who've done these kinds of cases, to see how much time that would take in addition. Would there be multiple hearings? How much time would that take on the part of senior judges? And that's important for what I'll get to here in a minute. In addition, it would remove the current Supreme Court appeal panel, which is made up of three judges, which hears the petitions from individuals who want to be released from custody, and instead put that role, again, on the part of individuals who are senior judges. Just for your information, the current number of appeals as averaged over the last 4 years, about 90 a year. If you take recent numbers of individuals who are currently committed, if it was about 700, and you're going to do these once every 2 years, that means we'd now have 350 reviews that are done every year. So it multiplies it about four times in terms of the number of reviews that need to be done. So those are increased responsibilities now put on senior judges. A little bit about senior judges. Senior judges currently is a roster that is maintained by my office. In order to be appointed to be a senior judge, somebody who has been a judge has to apply, and the orders are issued then by the Chief Justice as to whether somebody is appointed as a senior judge or not. They have to continue education requirements. They have to have no serious discipline by the Board on Judicial Standards. Currently, we have a roster of about 85 judges who have agreed to serve as senior judges, And those judges are used and are in high demand right now by our own judicial branch. We use senior judges to fill in if we have a vacancy and we're waiting for the governor to appoint someone new, if we have vacations, if we have lengthy illnesses by judges. So right now, our districts around the state are using these individuals on the roster for our own work of the judicial branch to fill those kinds of vacancies. So we need to do a little bit more studying of this issue, but my first initial concern, and we'd have some conversations with those who might want to draft a bill around this, is will there be the resources of senior judges to meet this need, the expanded need in the recommendations of the task force? And secondly, will we have senior judges who basically want to take this on as a full-time job so you have the consistency that the task force has recommended? What we do now in my office, if we're looking for senior judges, is people will go to the roster and start calling judges to see if they're willing to serve. Judges may go to Florida for the winter. They're retired. They may only want to take on a certain number of cases. They may want to do a couple cases a month. So it is not a pool of set individuals who are out there just looking for full-time work to do these kinds of cases. There may be a few, but as the workload is going to increase under the task force recommendations for this cadre of individuals, I think it is a legitimate logistical concern that we would want to talk a little bit with our senior judges about, talk with some of the judges who've done these kinds of cases, and probably look at some workload numbers for you to consider. As Chief Justice Magnuson said, there were other alternatives that were considered by the task force. I'm not here to recommend any of them, whether that be a referee or an administrative law judge. But I do think that's a consideration from our perspective that would need to be thought about. Those are the only issues I really had to prepare today, present today.
Oh, thank you. Do you have a question? Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Shorba. I could anticipate maybe a situation where some judges were awaiting their time to retire and may decide that if they retired a few years earlier, they might be in a position to apply for and serve on this particular body as a senior judge appointee, setting aside the implications for pension and everything else that also influence the timing of a judge's decision to retire. Could you see that as a possibility?
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, certainly
Mr.
I could
Charba see
that as a possibility. I think one of the things that we see with the senior judge ranks is it fluctuates. Right now, as the baby boomers are going through the judicial ranks, we have a higher number of people retiring who may be in that situation where they want to take on additional work or retire early. We have had situations where we've had very few retirements every year, and that could be a cause of concern if you want some consistency through this process. But I do think there may be individuals who find this work interesting and may want to take it on and retire early, certainly.
Oh, excuse me, Senator Nelson, I was just, before you start, I was just reflecting on, is there an interest in having judges retire early for some reason? Is there sometimes they give early retirement packages to various groups of people. Is there an interest like that in the court to having judges retire early?
Senator Sharon, actually, right now, I think in the court, the opposite is true.
Okay.
We have a large number of people retiring. We'd like to keep that.
Keep them. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Because we're losing a lot of knowledge, especially in some particular areas, by a lot of retirement. So.
Thank you. I was just thinking how we might encourage retirements by offering to fill out their pensions or their health benefits, and then if they agree to carry caseloads in this area. But where you don't want us to go. So.
And I don't know. Maybe the Minnesota District Judges Association have a different perspective on that. But
okay, we'll come back at that. Senator Nelson,
thank you, Madam Chair. My question is a very fundamental question, and so you may want to set it aside. I'm not sure if Mr. Shorba is the one who should answer this, or Justice Magnuson. But my question is of a very fundamental nature, and that is, it has to do with the federal court Judge Frank and his ruling. And what I'd like to know is, did he specify exactly what needs to change in our current MSOP in order that to preclude him from ruling it unconstitutional? And if indeed, then are those things contained, I would assume, in the advisory task force report? And is there anything over and above what is required to keep our program constitutional in this advisory task group. Task report.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. If you don't mind, I'm going to hold on your question a little bit because I don't think that you would want to take that question on. So if there are some more questions at this time or anything anyone would like to ask our court administrator, I really appreciate your coming here and spending your time with us. Let's then move to the next. I'm going to have former Chief Justice Eric Magnuson come to the table again, if you don't mind, and also Robin Benson, who is our deputy commissioner. There you are, Robin. I didn't see you. General counsel. His task is to talk about the Carstens hearing case. So I'll appreciate your comments about that, Mr. Benson. But we did review, and I'll just have you, because I think it works well with the report on the current situation with the case, what we do know the court expected us to do, and you can repeat your lack of certainty about whether or not what we're doing will be responsive enough, but then we can hear about the case itself.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson or Nelson, we don't know. First of all, the court has not issued an order, so we don't know specifically what the court will be concerned with. We do know that the court directed the Commissioner of Human Services to put this task force together and told her who he wanted, or at least the kinds of people he wanted on it, and then the court set the issues that we were to address. We also, as part of the task force consideration, looked at the allegations in the Carstens lawsuit. If you go to the webpage, DHS webpage for the task force, you will find a summary of the issues raised in the Carstens litigation. We have a good sense that it is the issues involve all of those things upon which we have made recommendations, but what the judge finally rules on the issues that are before him is something we can't. We could predict, but we have no guarantee we'd be right.
Senator Nelson, a follow-up.
Just to that line. And so it's kind of similar to what you said before. I'm just kind of processing all of this. And my question would be, is there anything in the task force report that is over and above what one would reasonably look at as being one of those issues that that could cause a ruling of unconstitutionality?
Madam Chair,
Judge Magnuson,
Senator Nelson, I don't know that over and above is quite right. We were directed by the federal court, or the commissioner was, to address three areas. In addressing those three areas, we were cognizant of the allegations in the Carstens litigation. But as you can see from the report, we also then looked at the discussion of issues on those topics that has arisen in the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report, the prior Governor Pawlenty task force, DOC's analysis, DHS's analysis. So I don't know that over and above is quite right. It may be that there's not perfect congruity between the issues being raised in the Carstens litigation and our recommendations, but we didn't see our task as answering the allegations in the Carstens litigation. We were directed to make make suggestions for potential legislative action in three specific areas, and that's what we did. So they may not be perfectly congruent, but there's a fair amount of overlap.
One final question.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Chair, along this line. And so I think we're all cognizant of the fact that we don't want to be put in a position where the Minnesota legislature and the Minnesota legislative or elected officials are not making these decisions and having a federal judge make some sort of decision that should be one made right here at the Capitol. But since we don't know exactly what it is that the judge or how he's going to rule, of course. What's the timeline? I'm not necessarily suggesting this, but I do want to know, what is the timeline if there was a ruling that our program was unconstitutional? What would we be looking at for a timeline then as far as the legislature being able to respond? You know, we've heard things like having, you know, the doors opened and 600 sex offenders released into our communities, and I can't imagine something like that could happen, but what kind of timeline is at stake here?
Madam Chairman.
Chief Justice.
Senator Nelson, I don't know the timeline. In the materials that you'll find on the website, there are copies of the orders filed by the federal court in Washington State that addressed a similar lawsuit. And you can see what the judge did there. He said, you've got such a period of time to do this, that, and the other thing. And when those weren't accomplished, he issued sanctions against the state. I don't know that we have citations or links to the California prison litigation, but that is another analogous lawsuit. Prisoners said that they were being confined unconstitutionally because of the conditions of the prison, and the federal court there said, okay, state of California, you have to do this, this, and this by this time, and the legislature in California didn't do it, and so he imposed sanctions and ultimately did release some prisoners. I don't know. There's no real way to predict the timeline that Judge Frank might impose because it depends on what he finds. And it ranges all the way from he could say, look, there are problems there, but they don't rise to the level of a constitutional violation. And if he finds that, then it's up to the state of Minnesota to run its own house. He may find serious constitutional violations and say these have to be remedied immediately. You know, it's like predicting school desegregation. The courts would issue the order with all deliberate speed. The public schools in Kansas City, Missouri should be desegregated. 25 years later, they were still fighting about whether they were desegregated. But what I can say is, when you're operating under a federal decree that you have to do things, it's not your timeline.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It is clear, though, that the court wanted the task force to make recommendations in three areas.
Madam Chair, yes, absolutely.
And that they spoke to the concern, that it was certainly an indicator to us to the areas of concern that they had about our law. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, it is.
All right, great. Mr. Benson, can you give us an update?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
This may also answer some of your questions, Senator Nelson.
Hopefully. My name is Robin Benson. I am Deputy General Counsel at the Department of Human Services, covering the area of the department that includes the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And as such, it goes without saying that I represent, at least in an in-house capacity, the defendants in this case. So you can measure my comments with that in mind. And in terms of providing an update on the Carstens litigation, I do need to note that there are obviously limitations upon what I can say in a public forum regarding that litigation, but I will provide what I can that is public knowledge, that is descriptive and objective, and not something that might tip our hand or might be an admission against interest that could be used against the state of Minnesota. To that extent, the disclaimer that the arguments and positions of the state are reflected in the pleadings filed in the court, not by my statements at all. So what do you expect from a lawyer? I think that it's important to recognize that this is the lawsuit and the task force are often referred to as the MSOP task force or the MSOP lawsuit, and really a understanding that this is about Minnesota's possessive case sex offender program. There is indeed a bricks and mortar facility that has about 700 individuals in its custody and care, has numerous employees and staff working diligently every day to provide and protect public safety. The task force and the lawsuit, though, also implicate Minnesota's system of sex offender civil commitment and the management of individuals who have demonstrated that they have harmed people in the past and have been adjudicated by courts to have a high risk of committing offenses in the future. The Department of Human Services has a significant but only singular role in that system, and as Chief Justice Magnuson and some of the questions that have been asked by members identify, there are multiple segments of that system of sex offender civil commitment and multiple roles to play and authorities and responsibilities, of which the department is simply the place where individuals are placed under civil commitment and receive treatment. There is an entire system of courts, county attorneys, the Department of Corrections on the front end before an individual ever becomes committed to the Commission of Human Services at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And this relates in terms of the overlap between the Carstens litigation and the work of the task force. As Chief Justice Magnuson identified, there were specific topics that the federal judge required the task force to address. There is some overlap between those topics and issues that were raised by the plaintiffs in the Carstens litigation, such as the availability of less restrictive alternatives to a secure facility commitment, also some of the discharge criteria and procedures. However, there are areas that the task force addressed that are not part of the litigation, and there are areas of the litigation that are not part of the task force. And I think that a helpful perspective on contextualizing both the litigation and the task force recommendations is that the topics identified by the court are those that are not necessarily resolvable by litigation. And perhaps that is a reason why there was this parallel process of a task force that was to propose legislative recommendations and the litigation, which will address some other issues. For example, the task force topics, one could identify the pattern that those relate to a lot of the systems and procedures and policies, really, high-level policy items for how individuals become civilly committed. And then on the back end, how do civilly committed individuals have a reduction in custody and eventual reintegration safely into the community? In the middle there is the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, with the conditions of confinement that the individuals experience on a daily basis as an incident of their commitment to a secure facility, and also the treatment that the state provides to reduce their future risk. It's the treatment issues and the conditions of confinement issues that the court did not assign to the task force and has assigned other expert groups to look at, but also those are issues that are directly involved in the litigation. So I hope that that provides some context for why the task force may not have addressed some issues and why the litigation may not address some issues that the task force did address. With that context, the update that I was asked to provide on Carstens will focus on what the court has, what was presented to the court on December 18th as motions made to it. And there have been no, as Chief Justice Magnuson has identified, there have been no rulings on the merits, so to speak, in this case. It has taken a path that may be somewhat different than other cases, but the subject matter is somewhat different too, so perhaps it merits that different procedural posture. But on December 18th, the court heard explicit motions by the parties that will result in what we believe will be some guidance from the court about where it is at and how it views some of the legal issues that are present in the cases. So the defendants, the state, moved to dismiss the plaintiff's complaint in its entirety on a motion to dismiss. It is about the legal issues and whether the plaintiffs have a right under the existing law to even assert a certain kind of claim, or that the previous rulings or precedent have foreclosed the types of claims that they're raising. So it doesn't get into factual issues other than those that are being alleged by the plaintiffs. That's the standard of review that the court exercises at that stage of the litigation. Now, at the same time that there was a motion to dismiss by the state, the plaintiffs, represented by court-appointed pro bono counsel, have three motions in play. The first of those is a motion for declaratory judgment, and they ask that Minnesota Statutes Chapter 253D, which contains the civil commitment laws, be ruled unconstitutional. That is a significant argument. That is a significant request to have the court make. The specific arguments that plaintiffs advanced as part of that were really focused on the discharge criteria and the asserted difference between what it takes to be civilly committed in terms of legal criteria and what they assert is a higher level of a higher threshold for someone to be fully discharged from civil commitment. Now, at the hearing before Judge Frank on the 18th, I believe Judge Frank indicated that he was not interested at that point on opening the doors and releasing all individuals as part of any of the motions that were being made at that time. He also indicated an interest in continuing the case, and to the extent we can speculate based on what we've seen, one could speculate that his ruling on the motions is going to result in is not going to result in the end of the case, that we will continue on with the case. It may be shaped a little bit differently based on what the court rules on some of the legal issues, but it won't be over. And that can leave both the plaintiffs and the defendants disappointed. So maybe that's the hallmark of a good court ruling, is everyone's disappointed and mad at it. The other motions that were made by the plaintiffs requested preliminary relief, preliminary injunctions that are based not on a final judgment or final ruling, but an assertion that the plaintiffs have certain rights that if action is not taken right away, they will be forever harmed and there would not be a satisfactory remedy at the end of the litigation to restore them to the position that they were at. The two preliminary injunctions sought, first of all, for the establishment of less restrictive alternatives to the current secure treatment facilities, and as part of that, to reevaluate every individual in the plaintiff class for possible transfer or provisional discharge to those facilities. And, of course, an effect of providing new facilities would be on the front end more options for committing courts to place individuals at the time of commitment. The other preliminary injunction motion made by plaintiffs was request the appointment of a special master to oversee the Minnesota sex offender program, specifically may not be the right word. It was a rather vaguely framed request of the court to simply put a special master in place until such time as the program is constitutionally adequate without identifying any benchmarks. Also, a part of that was to increase the staffing, clinical staffing at the Moose Lake facility, and also to reevaluate all current clients for their placement within the treatment program, which is divided into several phases. So that is and Judge Frank stated that he would have that his orders on all of those motions would be issued no later than February 16th. And the motion hearing was originally scheduled for February 14th, but was moved up almost 2 months by the court, which reflects kind of a accelerated pace that things have been going more recently than in the past.
So the original date was what was the original date that they moved it up to February 16th from?
The original hearing date on the Madam Chair, the original hearing date was February 14th for these motions. However, the court accelerated that so that the motions were heard on December 18th, so that a decision, any state decision, would be issued by February 16th.
I misunderstood what you were saying. Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? The current status of the case. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a series of questions, not to go more than 3 hours, I promise you. I know,
we will try to finish here in just a few moments.
You got it. I will, Madam Chair. I guess, I can maybe get these offline, but I got some numbers that seem to be confusing me. And the first one is those individuals in the MSOP program, and you'd mentioned some different numbers here. Can you accurately tell me how many of those have been identified that have a developmental disability or are developmentally disabled according to how we register that in Minnesota?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Currier.
Senator Hoffman, I don't have those numbers, and we can provide those to you offline, of course. I would say that identifying, there may be a distinction between identifying individuals who are diagnosed with a specific developmental disability versus a perhaps broader category of individuals who have various cognitive impairments that don't quite pass the threshold for a clinical diagnosis of developmental disability. And so there is that distinction among that kind of end of the spectrum.
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, with that, a follow-up. You know, under ADA, there are six different definitions of developmental disability. So if I could get the broad range numbers, that would be nice, as well as, Madam Chair, if I may, the 1,614 people that are under the GSO that are identified in the Department of Corrections. I'm wondering also if we could have those numbers as well that identify specifically that broad range within the six that we know under ADA.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
There, Senator Hoffman, there are approximately 112 individuals at MSOP who are in what is called the Alternative Program. It is housed at St. Peter, and it is intended for those with compromised executive functioning.
Okay.
So that is the larger pool, and there may be individuals within that group that would more specifically be diagnosed with developmental disabilities. I'd note that the Americans with Disabilities Act expressly excludes sex offenses and sex offenders under its coverage, and the individuals who are committed to MSOP are not committed as developmentally disabled by and large. That there may be, I think there may be one individual that has a developmental disability and sex offender dual commitment.
Are you finished, Senator?
Madam Chair, yeah, I just wanted to break out, Madam Chair, if I may, the distinction of those that have been labeled with developmental disability regardless of that, but they happen to be part of that program.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Oh, I have it. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one question. I'm not sure who can answer this, but in all the meetings I've gone through, I still don't know the answer to this one question. Are there juveniles that are committed to the MSOP program, and if so, are they held in the same facility as the adults?
Mr. Benson.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Limmer, there are no individuals who are of juvenile age who are committed to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. There are individuals who their only convicted or adjudicated offenses were committed as when they were juvenile age. There are some individuals either from that group who have only juvenile histories or offended early on in their adult history who are committed to the sex offender program and are young enough where they are placed in a unit for young adults to keep them out of the general population. There are individuals who have juvenile-only offense histories who by this time are in their 30s or 40s, so it's the shorthand for describing them as juveniles doesn't reflect maybe their current status. It reflects the age at which they were committing offenses.
So, Madam Chair, assured that a juvenile, if they are civilly committed, will not be a part of the adult population at an MSOP program.
Mr. Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Limmer. I don't have the age
until
criteria.
Perhaps after they become an adult.
Yeah. Well, they are not
Mr. Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Limmer, they are not committed until after they are adult age. Oh.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, that
yes, Mr.
raises one question.
Senator Limmer?
From a perspective of what is, does that individual, is there a civil commitment process for a minor?
Mr. Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Limmer, there is not civil commitment for sex offense, sexually dangerous person or sexual psychopathic personality. There is civil commitment categories such as MI or developmental disability that would apply, that could apply to a minor, and there is programming, some of it in corrections if they happen to be in the juvenile part of the correctional system, and there is programming that the department provides at a separate program in St. Peter for juveniles with sex offending or sexual misbehavior kind of histories. And I think that one of the issues with why an individual might be proposed for civil commitment based only on juvenile behavior is that when they age out of the juvenile correctional system or juvenile social services, what might be available to a juvenile through social services is perhaps a gap in the availability of services for them once they're an adult. And perhaps frustration on the part of a county attorney or county social services with not having other alternatives for them.
Well, thank you. Excuse me, Senator Nelson. Just think let's. I really think we need to wrap this up. We've been in that a while, so
yes.
Can you conclude with your question?
And then I will. Goes back to that first series of questions that I asked, and some more. And I appreciate the additional information that you both gave. And so I just want to make sure that I understand correctly. Judge Frank offered three. Said there's three areas of concern with our current program. He also indicated that he will not be releasing sex offenders onto the streets. Did I understand that correct, Mr. Benson?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Benson.
Yes. Yes. At the argument on December 18th, and I believe at the class certification hearing from July of 2012, he made statements to that effect. And I think it should be noted that the relief requested by plaintiffs generally was not open the door and let them out. It is do something to make it more constitutional.
So my last question then is,
Senator Nelson.
Would we not, why isn't it better to hear specifically what those concerns are? In other words, have the case tried? What is the harm in having the judge rule that it's unconstitutional and here's why? And then our legislation would address those specific concerns. At this point, and again, we don't want anyone released on the street, and we don't want to jeopardize public safety. But if that's not an issue, why would we not be better off addressing our legislation to the exact concerns that Judge Frank may or may not address in the ruling?
Would either of you like to choose to speak to that?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, let me take
former Chief Justice Magnuson.
Thank you. Let me take a crack at it. Senator Nelson, if the judge finds that there are constitutional violations, he may well say, and to remedy them, you must do A, B, and C. Those may not be choices that you would make. They may not be choices that are made with any thought to broader public policy, the financial consequences on the state. He, in my view, and I've said this before, I believe Judge Frank said, I'm going to give you a chance to tell me how you'd go about fixing these issues, and if you don't, then I'll tell you how you're going to fix them. And that may not be the way you want it done, but once the judge declares, should he do so, that there are constitutional violations, he will say, here's how I think you need to fix them. He may say, I want your proposal on how you're going to fix them. But at that point in time, he has kind of taken control of the situation. And where he drives the bus from there may not be where you would want it to go.
That answers my question.
Yeah. So thank you. Let me just summarize that for myself. Although he says that his remedy that he may make is not going to be releasing sex offenders directly to the street, that there will be remedy, and it may not be, and what you're saying is that remedy is now out of our control, and we don't design it according to what we think works best for the state, and we lose control over what that remedy is.
I think the good example is if you look at the Washington state litigation and at the California penal legislation, the decision went to the court. The court made the decision. The state didn't like what they were told to do. They didn't think they could do it. They didn't do it, and the judge sanctioned them for it. It's who's in charge is a big part of that.
So Madam Chair, the final comment, though, is that we're not sure, even if we take these task force recommendations, we have no guarantee that these are going to prevent Judge Frank from ruling that it's unconstitutional.
Chief Justice.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I think that's true.
Don't know.
But he has outlined the areas of concern and asked us to make recommendations for legislative action, and that's a very unusual step.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that Senator Nelson makes a point that we can't be assured that our recommendations will satisfy. We aren't guaranteed that those recommendations that are coming will satisfy the court. But we can be assured that if we don't make recommendations and changes and take actions, that they will. That we're clearly understanding that they have an obligation to make what we're doing constitutional from the court's perspective. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I think that that's a generally a correct statement. The judge decides justiciable controversies, and if things are changing, you know, he's not going to want to talk about the way they used to be if they are not that way now. And it will, I guess the best way I can say it is, in my judgment, if the state takes action and doesn't wait for the judge, they'll have a greater voice in the direction that the action goes, as opposed to saying, okay, just tell us what to do, Your Honor, because you may not like what he tells you to do.
Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Latz, this will be our farewell song from Senator Latz. I want to close the meeting out. I appreciate everybody for coming and the time that you've given to us and the active questioning of the committee. Thank you very much. Senator Latz, you can close us out.
So you want me to sing, Madam Chair?
Well, I would like that.
Happy birthday to you. Just a thought that, you know, the judge is going to decide constitutional questions, but it may or may not be the best public policy. And we as a legislature have a duty when we're elected to do the best public policy that's taking into the fiscal consideration the fiscal implications, taking into consideration the real human aspects of this case on all sides of the impacts from victims to public safety to the individuals that are in the program right now. You know, what meets a constitutional threshold that is generating the litigation and is driving Judge Frank's oversight. Even if we did something that minimally met that threshold, it still may not be the best thing for the state to do as a matter of public policy. And I think this task force has identified a lot of areas in which the best practices in this area would be well worth doing, whether or not they're necessary simply to get to the constitutional threshold. And I think that's our duty as public policymakers to evaluate it in that light, even if the driving force behind our motivation in addressing it now is because we are under the jurisdiction of the federal court. So that's the approach I'm trying to take, and I hope all of us here and on the other side of the Capitol as well will take a very serious consideration from the long-term public policy best interests of the state. We are all better off, I think, if we can find meaningful ways to treat folks and meaningful, safe ways for them to be reintegrated into the community. Not to mention even just the moral dimension of keeping someone in custody, essentially, I'll say it, I'm not in the court, for 60 or 70 years because of an offense they committed at age 21 or as a juvenile at age 16. There are certain moral dimensions to that. By the time they reach age 50, 60, 70, or 80, are they still public safety threats in their individual circumstances, yet we haven't had the political fortitude to develop a system that will recognize their status and treat them as they are at that time and not the way they were 40, 50, 60 years ago. So I think we need to have a system that's set up to evaluate that. And the constitutional question certainly is driving the issue before us today, but we need to look at it from a broader perspective when designing a system that will work effectively for the people of Minnesota. So there's my swan song.
Thank you,
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. And with that, we're going to close today's hearing. Thank you very much for coming, and thanks for all of our Senate members for coming. This is adjourned.